Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and with me for the remainder of today's show is food historian Andrea Broomfield. Later this week, she'll be participating in the Chow Challenge at World War I Museum. For that event, area chefs will be engaging in a World War I themed cooking competition. Andrea will be contextualizing their performances with a history of the role of food in World War I, both here and abroad. Hi, Andrea. Thanks for being here today.
Hi, Gina. Glad to be here.
First of all, I want to know a little bit about you because you are a food historian, and I'm intrigued by how you fell into that particular specialty.
Well, I've always been amazed at what and how people eat, and my earliest memories in life have to do with food. So I became an English major, and then from there I did a PhD in English literature, but my real underlying passion always had to do with culture, starting with the Victorians. And eventually it led to me deciding that I really wanted to pursue looking at how people ate in the Victorian period. So I put aside Victorian journalism, which was my specialty, and I started reading Victorian cookbooks, and I began to become fascinated by the Industrial Revolution and the effect that that had on the way people ate. And from there, it just took off. So that's how I became a food historian.
Do you hear the line of that nursery rhyme, 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie, any differently than the rest of us?
Maybe, just because I know that at the time that nursery rhyme was coming into popularity, people literally, if they were rich enough, were indeed eating foods like blackbirds in a pie because they liked the novelty of that. So, yes, I guess I might think of it more differently.
Well, what kinds of things were people eating in the years leading up to World War I here in the United States?
In the United States, at the end of the 19th century, food was becoming increasingly industrialized, which means that you began to see people eat not just better food, but also more food. And you might think, well, industrialization is a horrible thing, but the truth of it is that it allowed everyday working class people access to the kinds of foods that today we might take for granted, such as bread.
Explain that. Why was their access increased?
It was increased because the United States began to farm vast acres of prairie land, particularly in Kansas and in what we call the Prairie Belt. But they were beginning to farm it with mechanization. In other words, we began to see the use of gas engines to drive tractors as opposed to simply using livestock. And as the various varieties of wheat became improved and we were able to grow more and more wheat, and as the trains were able to bring in more and more livestock from the ranch land and send them to the meat packing houses that were here in Kansas City, people simply saw the price of food begin to drop so that working class people could afford foods that had traditionally been pretty much just available to the middle class and the wealthy.
And that includes bread?
Well, bread to the degree that it became cheaper because you had so much more wheat being produced and being produced more easily than it had been the case. Wheat production in the United States really takes off in the 1870s. With the introduction of what's called Turkey red wheat, which was a variety that was brought over with the Mennonites from Russia. And this particular kind of wheat grew exceptionally well in dry and arid climates, which meant that suddenly we were able to produce a lot of wheat. And so, yes, the cost of bread goes down because the wheat is so much more readily available.
How did our involvement, the United States' involvement in World War I, affect what people's dinner tables looked like once that conflict had taken hold?
Do you mean during the war with
mm-hmm.
rationing?
Right, yeah.
Well, there's a person that I'd like to talk a little bit about because I think people today don't have quite as high opinion of him as we might otherwise, and that's Herbert Hoover. Herbert Hoover was a young engineer who was living in London when the war broke out, and his initial role was to help orchestrate the United States' involvement in making sure that the people in the countries in Europe that were engaged in the war were able to get some food relief. But he becomes ultimately what you might call a food dictator in the United States. And I mean this in the most positive of ways, because when the United States enters the war, Herbert Hoover is put in charge of the what was called the U.S. Food Administration. And he was able to orchestrate this extraordinary propaganda campaign to get housewives in particular, because at this time most of the food went through the kitchen. He was able to secure the pledge of so many housewives to agree to limit the amount of wheat and the amount of beef that was being served at the dinner table so that the troops, the Allies, as well as the U.S. soldiers would have enough to eat. And he's really at the height of his game with this U.S. Food Administration and his ability to ensure that Americans don't go hungry and that the U.S. troops and the Allied troops don't go hungry, I think, is really important to his history. But it's something that tends to get overlooked because we're more focused on what happens during the Great Depression and the Hoovervilles.
Well, that's an interesting thing. I read that he had kind of a line that he used when he was talking later on about the role of food policy in World War I, and he said, after the war, at our normal rate of export, the Allies would have starved. The organization and expenditure of our food resources contributed no less than the Army and Navy to winning the war. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I think that he's able to, he understands because of the time that he had spent in war-torn Europe, the fundamental role that food played in whether or not a country would be able to win the war or if the country would be defeated in war.
What had he witnessed in Europe?
When he is living in London and the war breaks out, essentially in the early part of August in 1914, the first thing to happen of monumental importance to the food source is that Germany invades Belgium in order to reach France. And the people in Belgium are in a country where a lot of the food is already at that point being imported. And so the food sources dry up fairly quickly because the soldiers, of course, are also eating the food that the Belgians would have eaten. And Hoover is able, because the United States at this time in its history is an isolationist nation, is able to convince the Germans as well as the British to allow food relief to come into Belgium and also in the early part of the war into the German-occupied part of France. And he's overseeing at one point something like feeding 10 million people in these war-torn countries a day. And he understands, because he's there on the ground, that if people don't have enough to eat, of course, they're not going to be able to fight a war. And they're also going, civilians lose their morale, mutinies take place. And so it's vital to keep the infrastructure of a nation strong with its food sources in order that you can continue to support what's happening on the front lines.
As far as citizens maintaining their morale, here at home, we did have rationing, and then there were the meatless and wheatless
That's
days.
Right.
And I'd like you to explain those, but I wonder, how did that affect people's morale? How did that affect people's attitude toward the war itself?
One of the important things to realize about rationing during World War I is that Hoover was very careful not to enforce rationing on individual citizens. There were several laws that were passed that controlled the ways that businesses, restaurants, for example, were using food, or breweries were using food. But what he relied on for American citizens was simply a full-scale propaganda campaign to convince American citizens that every time they ate wheat or they ate meat, they were potentially taking those essential calories away from a soldier on the front line, or they were taking those calories away from the Allied forces.
So people were doing this for the most part voluntarily.
They were, but to make this work effectively, Hoover was able to recruit something like 500,000 women volunteers to the U.S. Food Administration. And what these women did is they would dress in a uniform of sorts. It was a sort of a white nurse-looking uniform for that time period with a cap with the U.S. Food Administration insignia on it, and they would go door to door. And through their efforts, they were able to reach something like half of all United States housewives. And they would come into the house and sit down with them and go over, here is the strategy, the voluntary ration plan that we want your family to follow. And they would persuade these women to sign these pledges. And if they signed the pledge, then the family could display a placard in their window along with the star or stars for how many of their boys over there were fighting to show that they were a part of the volunteer rationing program here on the home front. And this program was highly successful. Our wheat reserves, our meat reserves stayed steady. And indeed, the American troops, the doughboys, as they were popularly called, were able to continue to eat better than the rest of the soldiers on the battlefield.
What have you looked through recipes that emerged during this time period?
I have.
Anything look tasty, or is it sort of a sad, sad time and one that people were probably eager to be done with?
Well, you know. We live in a time where a lot of Hoover's advice on how to eat is really actually quite popular with the American public today. And some of the recipes are kind of interesting to me. There's one where you would breadcrumbs were very important. In other words, you never wanted to waste any food at all, and breadcrumbs were probably something that Americans typically wasted. And so what happens with wartime recipes would be that you would collect all of the breadcrumbs. And there was a recipe called grandmother's bread. And what that meant is that you would collect all of the stale bread and you would grind it very finely so that it resembled flour. And then you would add that to the bread that you were making for that week. And that way you were able to stretch the wheat further and you were able to sneak in leftover breadcrumbs so that people didn't necessarily know that they were eating recycled bread there at the dinner table. They thought they were eating fresh bread that night. Some recipes that probably people today might even consider making, a lot of people had gardens. And so if you had a lot of tomatoes, you would take your tomatoes and you would hollow them out and you would stuff them again with breadcrumbs, the stale bread from the last week before. And cheese was awfully popular. You'd moisten that with a little bit of meat stock. You'd pile that into the tomatoes, and then you would broil that. And I think that's something that people can actually imagine eating today and not being too grossed out by.
Now, you mentioned meat reserves and wheat reserves. Are those things that we still maintain in this country?
I think I'm not really an expert on our reserve food in the United States today, but I do think that many people who are food advocates and who are paying attention to food policies would say that the United States is not equipped in terms of its food policy for a major conflict were it to happen today. But I can't speak exactly to what our reserves are like with meat and wheat.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is Central Standard. We're talking with Andrea Broomfield, who is a local food historian participating later this week on Wednesday at the Chow Challenge at the World War I Museum, where area chefs will do their best to compete against one another in creating World War I-esque food. Andrea, we've talked a lot about the United States food policy during wartime. What about abroad? I get the feeling that we don't often recognize the role of Germany's food policy in kind of possibly undermining itself.
Mm-hmm. Germany and Austria and Russia all suffered significantly. The soldiers suffered and the civilians suffered from near famine. In some cases, I think it could be argued that actual famine took over. Germany's situation is affected in part by its geography, in that when the war broke out, German officials and the military were keenly aware of the fact that even though they had ports to the Baltic and to the North Sea, in order to reach the open waters of the Atlantic, they would have to go through the English Channel or they would have to go around Scotland. And so the assumption was that if any major conflict broke out between Great Britain and Germany, Obviously, food blockades would be a part of the strategy to defeat the enemy. So when the war does break out, Germany is immediately faced with blockades. And at that time, something like at least a third to maybe a little more than a third of their food was indeed imported. They were able to sustain themselves in terms of the rye, which was the main cereal crop for bread, potatoes and turnips, and a majority of their orchard fruit, and also sugar beets, which were essential for producing sugar. But their meat and their dairy and most of the fruits and vegetables, the sugar, had to be imported from elsewhere.
What did people know at that time about the nutritional importance of having some of these foods that you're talking about them not having access to?
It's really right around the time of World War I, and actually because of the work of a lot of German chemists, that we're beginning to understand vitamins and minerals. There's already a good understanding of proteins and carbohydrates and how they affect a person's ability to move and to do hard work. But vitamins that's cutting edge research at the time that the war is breaking out. And in fact, a lot of the German chemists at the time, as well as in the United States and Great Britain, are desperately attempting to figure out how can you achieve the maximum amount out of a little bit of food to keep a soldier on the front line able to fight, and a munitions worker in a factory able to produce artillery. So this is all very new at the time, and World War I soldiers might be considered guinea pigs, really, in how nutritionists are trying to figure out the appropriate balance of minerals and nutrients in the food.
And you've mentioned calories during this conversation.
Yeah.
Was that a concept? I mean, was that word used?
The word was used. But again, the kind of experiments that are taking place to figure out how many calories a body needs in order to function, that's still very, very novel research at the time.
All right. So back to Germany's food policy.
Right.
So is it both civilians and soldiers who are really struggling to find enough sustenance and enough variety of sustenance during this time?
Yes. When the war starts, Germany, like Britain and France, the rations for the soldiers as well as for the civilians are adequate. But Germany is the country that very quickly begins to start feeling the pinch of these blockades. And in terms of the Germans, they're the first country to begin rationing. They begin with bread. The soldiers on the front line are likewise starting to feel the effects of less food. And by the end of the war, many German soldiers are emaciated. They're down to this horrific diet of what they called turnip coffee, which was, I can't quite picture what it would look like, but it was obviously a thin, probably unheated gruel that they were eating for both their breakfast and their supper, along with bread. And their main meal of the day, their so-called dinner, was usually a clear soup that had some dried vegetables floating around in it. And if they were lucky, it might be thickened with potato.
Okay, that sounds awful.
These troops are literally starving, and in the early days of the war, the soldiers would leave the dead horses there to just rot. But it's very quickly into the war that the Germans are actually taking those dead horses and immediately slaughtering them to try to stretch out the field rations. On the home front,
so the soldiers are doing that themselves. Did they know how to do that in a way that was sort of sanitary and healthful?
Well, they knew to do it quickly. They knew that if they allowed too much time to pass, the meat would begin to putrefy very quickly. But of course, what you're trying to do is you're trying to haul these carcasses off the field and out of the line of fire in order to butcher them. And you don't have much equipment to do this appropriately, and you certainly don't have much room to do it appropriately. So it's a desperate situation.
Did Germany have a chance at winning the war with this food policy? I mean, if all other things being equal, is this food policy like a nail in the coffin of their war effort?
I would say it is, because even though you have the intention of major military offenses that are coming out of Germany at the very end of the war, you also have so many soldiers who are starving and they are deserting. At the end, are probably fairly desperate to be taken prisoner by the Americans, because there's food. So I can't say that that the food policy in any way helped, and I think that ultimately it probably was a critical factor in the ability of Germany to continue fighting.
Well, back to what was going on here at home with the rationing and food policy, where the civilians were really taking it upon themselves to restrict their own diets in favor of sending those calories and those nutrients
right.
to their soldiers and to the Allies abroad. A criticism that I've heard of America's more contemporary relationships with its conflicts abroad is that, for example, with the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, life didn't change that much for people here at home. And the notion of the citizen soldier, which was kind of a popular notion in World War I, didn't quite take root. We were never asked to observe
right.
meatless or wheatless days. So how do you, having done this kind of research, how do you feel looking at our relationship with our day-to-day lives and our daily food consumption and our conflicts abroad?
I guess that I probably spend more time anxious than otherwise, because I really do believe that not having a well thought out food policy, not understanding our food vulnerabilities, can make us very much a target to the enemy, whoever the enemy might be. And I also think that soldiers' morale will be greatly affected by the quality of the food that they are indeed eating.
What would you say are our food vulnerabilities right now?
I would say that we rely heavily on monocultures, so that if something were to decimate the corn or the wheat that we grow in abundance, that we immediately would have a food risk there. Hoover was a great advocate for local food, and that was because of the amount of gasoline it took to haul food from location to location. So one of his major pieces of advice to Americans during World War I that I think we should definitely follow is to make sure that we have good local food supplies, because gasoline is a limited resource, as is oil.
Well, that it is interesting that you're raising the issue of local food, and then that we've talked about wheat-free food, which
right.
With the gluten-free craze yes. that's popular right now.
Right.
When the chefs this week at the Chow Challenge are preparing their World War I foods, I mean, is this going to be kind of like an all-organic, local, gluten-free diet?
Well, I have absolutely no knowledge of what those chefs are going to see when they open their baskets. I do know that probably it will be foods that were available via the ration, but my guess is we won't see a whole lot of wheat.
So
and
they'll
we
be
won't
given
see a lot of meat.
Explain how it works. They'll be given a basket full of food that they would have had available to them during this time.
Well, it's definitely an Iron Chef type of competition, and so it will begin with each of the competing chefs opening. I don't know if it's a basket or if they'll see a platter or what, but they will learn right then and there what exactly they're going to have to create this meal with.
When you were doing this research and reading recipes, did you come across any advice that, should these chefs be listening right now, you would pass along to them?
I would say that these chefs are so lucky that we have Google Books, because they can access so many interesting recipes via Google Books through full text, recipes that come from Great Britain, recipes that come from the United States. And as for Germany, I think that a couple of them are probably fluent in German and will be able to make use of those too.
Well, that's all the time we have left for this conversation about food and food policy in wartime, particularly during World War I. Thanks so much to food historian Andrea Broomfield for joining us today. She works at the Johnson County Community College. It's been really informative having you here with us.
Thank you, Gina.
The Warfare Chow Challenge event at the World War I Museum will take place at 5:30 this Wednesday evening. For details, go online to theworldwar.org. That website again is theworldwar.org. Tune in tomorrow at 10 for conversations with a formerly local actor known for his role in House of Cards, as well as a National Geographic photographer. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Christy Garten and intern Kate Baxendale. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Linda Scher is our announcer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's all for Central Standard today. But stay tuned for Up to Date next.